from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Great narrative journalism is fine storytelling built on fact. This month, some of the country's best writers met in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism to share some of their best work. Over two nights this week, as part of our annual On Point holiday tradition, we'll bring you a selection of their stories from across the country, delivered in the writers' own voices. The conference was organized by Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. Tonight, we'll hear the story of one writer's first encounter with a shotgun, the story of a 17-year-old lesbian growing up in Newark, New Jersey, the story of a survivor of the Cambodian killing fields experiencing her first 4th of July celebration, and more. Tonight on Point, the best of narrative journalism, 2004. We begin tonight with Hank Stuever reading from his recent book, Off-Ramp, Adventures and Heartache in the American Elsewhere. Here, he reads from a story about the TV show Trading Spaces, on the road and redecorating in Plano, Texas.
She enjoys the power of suggestion on a $1,000 budget laid out here on the everyday turf of the great masses. In Seattle, she spray-painted two old love seats hot pink. Quote, it would have worked, too, she emphasizes, if the crew and homeowners hadn't left the couches out in the rain. Hildy Santo Tomas declared victory anyway. Spray-painting sofas is now thought by countless viewers to be within the realm of the possible. They were ugly already, she says. At the time of the taping of the Plano, Texas episode, Hildy Santo Tomas is 41 years old. She refused to tell me her age, even after I told her that I must know, because viewers couldn't decide if she was in her 40s or somewhat younger. Her stern insistence on her own sophistication, her skill level, suggested years of experience, but her low-rise Gucci pants, her stiletto Manolo Blahnik stepping around drop claws suggested something else. Finally, I had to do the despicable thing and look it up by running her identity through motor vehicle and credit bureau databases. She was about to be married to a very rich older man and moved to Paris, while still managing her decorating business in Atlanta and taping her share of Trading Spaces episodes, 18 per season. In the present tense, she is driving her rented Jaguar around Plano on the evening before the house swapping, slamming on the brakes when she sees a Pier 1 in a strip mall. Douglas Wilson, the other designer, is following in his rented minivan. The two have already blown into an enormous Lowe's home improvement warehouse with the vague panic of people looking to prepare for a hurricane, announcing to the paint lady the exact colors they'll need. The paint lady seems unaware of the celebrities in her midst. Then they coast over to the lumber department where they bicker with carpenter Ty Pennington about measurements and cost. Now they are back on the rush hour suburban boulevards looking for, in no particular order, a fabric store, a Bed Bath & Beyond, a TJ Maxx, and some decent sushi. Customers and stores recognize them and whisper. A cashier in Target pleads, "We all come to my house. It needs something." It's as if they've been here 100 times. There's this intuitive landscape to what urban planners and academics often derisively refer to as the geography of nowhere. A Target always indicates the presence of a TJ Maxx nearby. The Pier 1 means you're getting ever so close to a full-fledged mall. This homogenous world unnerves and occasionally offends Hildy Santo Tomas on some aesthetic level, even as it supplies her raw materials. She recalls, as she pushes a wobbly wheel cart through Target, when she first looked at Angie and Jeff's bedroom, I said, "Why are we here? This room is done, more or less. These houses are all alike. The walls are painted. They have their furniture. It looks, you know, how they would want it to look. But see, that's just it," she says. "A room like this, you have to really think of something new. I am going to do something that, okay, they might not like. I'm going to completely change it." She's going for something like a boutique hotel room in Miami. It will be all white, except for the bottom 12 inches of the wall and the carpet, which will be dyed orange. Douglas Wilson, who is 37, navigates his way across the suburban grid, considers his option for the game room, and settles in with his last-minute barn concept. Green walls, faux rafters, corduroy. He thinks of what the futon frame would look like if he took it apart and rebuilt it. It was Douglas Wilson who designed the chocolate room with the wainscoting that made Puyallup Pam cry in Washington. "Once it's over, we're still there," he says. "It's not like I was already on a plane trying to get away." I want to know if he ever got to apologize to Pam, or if he felt he should have. "I liked the room. I thought it worked. So many people thought it worked. I didn't apologize," he says carefully. "I said, I'm sorry it disappoints you." We've lost the day's sun. We're also turned around, lost among the starter mansions of Texas. He talks about his own apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side, all 500 rent-controlled square feet of it, the bare bulb fixtures, the Spartan furnishings, the lack of color. He hasn't had time to decorate. Thanks.
That was writer Hank Stuever reading from his book Off-Ramp, Adventures and Heartache in the American Elsewhere. Next up is Anne Hull, enterprise reporter at the Washington Post. This year, she wrote about gay teenagers in America. Here, she reads from a story about Felicia Holt, a 17-year-old lesbian living in Newark, New Jersey, who's getting ready for a night out on the town.
The belt buckle says sexy. The silk jersey says Denver Nuggets. Both are laid out on the bed as Felicia Holt stands at the ironing board, trying to press some perfection into her Friday night. Her T-shirt is fresh from the store package and goes on warm. Two dabs of Egyptian musk oil on the neck, hair braided short like an NBA star, a do-rag carefully tied over her braids. A voice rolls down the hall. "Felicia, is your room clean?" "Yeah, Ma." Felicia picks a cap from her vast collection on the dresser and stands in front of the mirror. With sleepy eyes and a smooth jaw, she cocks her chin with satisfaction. What stares back is the creamiest thug on the block. To be a young lesbian from the trash-blown and violent streets of Newark takes a measure of imagination. Felicia uses a soapy toothbrush to buff her Timberlands diligently and delicately, still believing that a Friday night can hold some wonder. She contemplates the splendor of Jersey Gardens Mall until she remembers the weekend crowds on a city bus, everyone packed like sardines and breathing each other's necks. "No seats," Felicia says, fastening on her rainbow necklace. "I got a date and I don't want her to stand." What is gay America? It is this 17-year-old who lives with her mom and two teenage sisters in an apartment on working class Eckert Street. There's a Bible on the coffee table and fish frying in the kitchen. With no cell phone to receive text messages, Felicia keeps her folded love notes in a shoebox. "I just want to kick it with you," one girl writes. In courtrooms, state houses, and city halls across the country, a historic battle is being fought over the expansion of rights for gay people. Far below the revolution is Felicia Holt, whose life is as hidden from the national debate as a box of stashed love notes. She cares less about wedding bells than dodging stray bullets and storefront preachers who keep the word abomination on the tips of their tongues, reserved for the likes of this high school senior now pulling the brim of her hat low over one eye. Newark, brick city, 28% living in poverty, 54% African American, 30% Hispanic. Newark is just a $1.50 path train ride from Manhattan, but Felicia hardly ever crosses the river. Her world is Newark, and she knows every inch of it, every shortcut through every vacant field. The Pabst Brewery has been boarded up since her childhood, but the giant bottle on the roof is still the neighborhood North Star. Leafy suburbs have their after-school gay organizations and parent support groups. Felicia's Newark has nothing. On Friday nights, a rattle-trap teen dance hall called the African Globe is the one beacon in an otherwise empty landscape for gay teenagers. They descend by the hundreds, Felicia among them, waiting to get inside their dingy sanctuary. Felicia felt none of the windfall of victory many American gays experienced last year when the Massachusetts High Court allowed same-sex marriage in that state. Getting married was someone else's dream. Felicia was more worried about staying alive. For Felicia, that feeling intensified in May 2003 with the killing of her friend, a 15-year-old lesbian named Sakia Gunn, who was at a bus stop downtown when she rejected a man's pickup attempt with the declaration that she was gay. A fight followed, and Sakia was stabbed to death. The slaying was Newark's version of Matthew Shepard, the gay college student found beaten and lashed to a fence post in 1998 in Wyoming. In Shepard's case, gay and lesbian organizations flew into the town of Laramie to maximize the political moment. President Clinton spoke out against the hate crime, and in New York, thousands of protesters marched down Fifth Avenue. No such forces rallied around the poor black teenager from Newark. When Felicia heard the news about Sakia, she rushed downtown to the bus stop where her friend had been killed. Dozens of other young black lesbians were already gathered at the corner of Broad and Market, and more kept arriving, bringing Knicks jerseys, mass candles, cardboard eulogies that said, "Stop the killing," or "Rest your head, baby girl." The teenage shrine grew in gaudiness and emotion, and not even rain or darkness sent the mourners home. The teenagers clung to the bloody patch of sidewalk in a stubbornness that suggested a political awakening. The vigil was just the start. A few days later, nearly 400 marched from the bus shelters to City Hall, demanding that Newark's Mayor Sharp James do more to protect gay youth. By the day of Sakia's funeral, Sakia had become a martyr. Perry's funeral home had prepared for only a modest crowd, but hours before the service began, young people were lining up to view Sakia's body in a small room upstairs. She was laid out in a powder blue tracksuit. When the 1 p.m. service started, the funeral director, Samuel Arnold, glanced out the front window, and all he could see on the lawn and up and down Mercer Street in front were young people. He guessed there were 2,000 mourners standing outside. After the funeral, Felicia took stock of her life. She looked like Sakia, she dressed like Sakia, and she braided her hair like Sakia. The smart thing would have been to ditch the men's clothing and rainbow gear. That struck Felicia as cowardly, if not disingenuous. She decided to go out into the world just like she was. The thumpty thump of rap is how she seems, but deep down, Felicia is old school. Her earliest memories are of R&B music that her parents listened to as they drove around with her in a car seat. The songs today are about Glocks and bitches, but Felicia clings to Patti LaBelle. Her eyelashes curl like a fawn's. She has milk chocolate skin as smooth as blown glass. A cubic zirconium glints from her left earlobe. Felicia can strut with the best of them, talking about what girl she souped or smashed, her Tim's unlaced and all yo-yo-yo, but her ankle socks say, "Hug me." When her mom was hospitalized last year with pneumonia, Felicia was so terrified that she wore a dress for her senior photo, knowing it was the one gift that could cheer up her ailing mother. Then it was back to the T-shirts that hung like bedsheets at her kneecaps. Felicia's natural state is a tomboy state. Jumbo clothes, inhaling bags of ranch chips, storing a rolled-up chemistry book in her back pocket, and giving girls playful headlocks in the halls at Westside High School. Even in the sixth grade, she knew she was different. Her sisters wore foxy lingerie and gold chains, but Felicia felt right, deeply right, in sports bras and wife beaters. She went all swirly inside watching Aaliyah videos. The grooves of her yearnings cut deeper, and she told no one. She'd spent enough Sundays in church pews to know that homosexuality is considered a sin. The preacher said it was a choice, something that could be overcome with prayer and willpower. The matter seemed out of Felicia's hands. "I didn't choose nothing," she said. "It chose me." Thank you.
Anne Hull is an enterprise reporter with the Washington Post. More readings after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to top American journalists reading their work at the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Next up is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. Here, he reads from his muckraking book on the Bush administration and Iraq, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib.
The perception persists that this was Rumsfeld's war, and that it was his assertiveness and his toughness that sometimes led to the bombing of the wrong target or the arrest of innocents. But Cheney's involvement in trying to conceal the import of Abu Ghraib was not unusual. It was a sign of teamwork at the top. George Bush had talked about smoking them out of their holes and wanting them dead or alive, and Rumsfeld was the one who set up the mechanism to get it done. The defense secretary would hold the difficult news conferences and take the heat in public, as he did about Abu Ghraib. But the president and the vice president had been in it and with them all the way. Rumsfeld handled the dirty work and kept the secrets, but he and the two White House leaders were a team. Again, to go on to say there's so much we don't know and never will know. It's very sort of sad. And how did they do it, et cetera. And then in the end, you say that as he campaigned in the summer of 2004, George Bush repeatedly reassured audiences, this was written in late August, this part, that his policies had made America safer. We've turned the corner, was the refrain in his stump speech. We're moving America forward by extending freedom and peace around the world. You heard me say earlier, he's still saying, that's still his mantra today. Iraq and Afghanistan, he said, are now governed by strong leaders. They're on the path to free elections. America would engage its enemies around the world, quote, so we do not have to face them here at home. The president did not mention the missing weapons of mass destruction, the growing GI death toll, the civilian casualties in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the devastation to all aspects of civil life in Iraq. He did not mention the adverse Supreme Court decisions in June of 2004 that challenged the legal basis of his post-war prison system and told him that foreigners as well as American citizens were entitled to due process even in a time of war. And he did not discuss growing alienation and bitterness as Americans already torn by racial and religious differences became increasingly politically and economically divided in the past 4 years. We have a president who spent months terrorizing the nation with dire warnings about mushroom clouds emanating from Saddam Hussein's arsenal, and then could say, as he did in a campaign speech in August of 2004, that it did not matter. We may still find weapons, Bush said. We haven't found them yet. Let me just say this to you. Knowing what I know today, we still would have gone into Iraq. We have a president who can stand aside as the dogs of war turn loose on prisoners and then declare, I'm referring to that horrible, iconic photograph that the New Yorker published, in other sequences that we did not publish, the dog did attack the man. And there were pools of blood. It was quite unbelievable. We have a president who can stand aside as the dogs of war turn loose on prisoners and then declare, as he did in June 2004, that, quote, America stands against and will not tolerate torture. We will investigate and prosecute all acts of torture and undertake to prevent other cruel and unusual punishment in all territory under our jurisdiction, and that, quote, freedom from torture is an inalienable human right. There are many who believe George Bush is a liar, a president who knowingly and deliberately twists facts for political gain. But lying would indicate an understanding of what is desired, what is possible, and how best to get there. A more plausible explanation is that words have no meaning for this president beyond the immediate moment. And so he believes his mere utterance of the phrases makes him real. It is a terrifying possibility. That's unfortunately the end of the book. Pretty terrifying. It remains even worse. Anyway, I'm going off. I'll be in the bookstore for a little while. And then I'll be selling uppers on the corner.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh, writer for The New Yorker magazine. Bruce DeSilva directs the news features department for the Associated Press. Tonight, he reads from a piece written for Memorial Day about his father's reluctance to remember his own war service.
My father's ankle-length black and white tweed Mayfield, the first fine piece of clothing he bought for himself when he returned from the war, hangs still in my crowded closet. Once a year I slip it from the hanger and try it on, always astonished that I cannot squeeze into the giant's coat. I picture him draped in it, towering over me as we stand beside his Robin's Egg Blue 1948 Plymouth Coupe. A snap-brimmed fedora pulled low over his twinkling eyes, his mouth curled in the confident smile of a man who knows he helped save the world. But behind his eyes, something dark lurked. Even as a child, I could sense it, a bone-deep sadness, or was it some horror that I could not name? I ached to know his demon, but I couldn't form the question and lacked the courage to ask it. Instead, I'd ask about the scar I could touch, a railroad track of puckered pink that bloomed at the center of his right forearm, curved north at the elbow, and ended at his shoulder. "Why don't you tell him about it, Al?" my mother would say. "Evelyn," he'd say, "some things are best forgotten." Alvaro de Silva never was much of a talker. Few of them were, those legions who left our shores as boys and returned as men. When the subject was war, even the blabbermouths among them usually chose silence. What could you tell a wife, a child, a buddy who got a deferment, about the fatal beauty of tracer bullets arcing through a foreign night, about wallowing in mud for so long that it became your second skin, about arms and legs and heads that suddenly learned how to fly? When I was small, we had a black-and-white Philco television. Whenever Dad walked in on me watching the World War II documentary series Victory at Sea, he'd leave the room or turn the channel. One night when I was about 12, Dad brought a friend home for dinner. After Mom cleared the dishes, I sat with the men hypnotized as the friends spun war stories. They were what I'd longed to hear from Dad, tales of adventure, of glory, of killing krauts. "It's getting late," Dad finally said, although it wasn't, and he hustled the blowhard out the door. Then he wheeled on me, angry, the demon restless behind his eyes. "That's not how it was," he said. "Anyone who talks like that wasn't there." It was around then, if I remember it right, that Dad's army dress greens vanished from his closet, but I'd gazed at the uniform long enough to remember the round patch sewn to the right shoulder, a gray head of a howling wolf on a field of dark green. It was the insignia of the Timberwolves, the 104th Infantry Division, composed of conscripts drawn from the length and breadth of the nation in the bleak year of 1942. America was building a vast army virtually from scratch, gathering coal miners from Pennsylvania, auto workers from Detroit, farm boys from Georgia, and Al de Silva, a young butcher from Taunton, Massachusetts. Dad was 22 when he entered the service on December 2, 1942, and was sent to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, to be trained on the BAR, the Browning automatic rifle. The weapon was 47.8 inches long, Private de Silva just 66 inches tall. On June 6, 1944, when radios crackled with the news of D-Day, word came that he would be shipped to Europe by the end of the month. Dad pleaded for a 10-day furlough, caught a train to his hometown, and proposed to the woman he would stay married to for 54 years. In the wedding photo, the bride, sheathed in a gown of ivory satin, stands beside the soldier who must soon leave her. He is picture book handsome in his tan summer dress uniform, a wolf howling from the shoulder. Commanded by the flamboyant Major General Terry de la Mesa Allen, the 18,000 men of the 104th landed in France on September 7, 1944. On October 23rd, they were blooded, the first of an extraordinary 195 consecutive days of combat. The 104th helped drive the enemy from Holland, then penetrated deep into Germany. Private de Silva didn't make it that far. He was one of the division's battle casualties, 5,305 wounded, 1,294 dead. I never stopped trying to fill the hole in Dad's story. It became a ritual between us. Once a year, I'd ask him to tell me what happened in Holland. He'd grimace and shake his head no. In November of 1997, Mom roasted the traditional turkey, and my three grown children and I sat down with my parents to share what we sensed might be my dad's last Thanksgiving. In the middle of the meal, my youngest son, Jeremy, dared the demon. "Grandpa, tell us how you got wounded." My father froze, a forkful of mashed potatoes suspended halfway between mouth and plate. I held my breath. What happens now in the piece is a description of the battle in which my father was badly wounded in Holland and was left lying on the ground between the lines for 13 hours until help could reach him. And then the piece ties up like this. With that, Dad stopped talking. My children and I stayed silent, sensing there was something more. When he spoke again, it sounded as if memory had thickened his tongue. "I shot one of my own men," he said. It happened in the confusion of the initial exchange when he opened up with the BAR. "Oh, Al," my mother said, "you can't know that for sure." He was right in my line of fire, Evelyn, he said, and there was a hole in the middle of his back. Never before had I seen my father look ashamed. The emotion was palpable, like a stifling cloak. My oldest son, Richard, was the first to speak. Are you kidding me? You're a hero. But the hero, stunned by his own history, lowered his head and silently refused the honor. I couldn't fathom my father's courage in choosing to shoulder such a burden alone. On his face, I glimpsed the demon that had ripped at the souls of millions of other fathers, men who were asked a lifetime ago to save the world, and did. On March 15, 1998, the day after his 76th birthday, my father's heart finally quit. At the funeral service, I rose and looked out over the faces of family and friends, one of them a frail old man who carried shrapnel in his body from Anzio. I miss Dad, I said. I think we all will the next time the world needs saving. Some things are best not forgotten. Thank you.
Bruce Da Silva directs the news features department for the Associated Press. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tomas Alex Tezon is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Here he reads from a story, Shotgun Day, about the day he first got his hands on a shotgun.
Have you ever seen a bird explode? I have. It was poof. A sudden cloud of blood and feathers. At least that's what it looked like from my view, standing about 20 feet away. I made it explode with a single shot. And then I walked up to see it up close, and what I found had no resemblance to the living thing it was just a few seconds earlier. It was just mangled feathers and meat, and not much of it. It was a small bird, I don't know what kind. How I let myself do that, I'm still trying to understand. I was just shy of 17, a new kid in town, wanting to be one of the guys, I guess. When Lance Davis asked me if I wanted to go hunting with him, I said, yeah, sure, without a pause. Lance was the guy that all the other guys wanted to be. Strong and funny and charming, but also with a little bit of a mean streak, so people were kind of afraid of him. He came by in his pickup, and we drove deep into the desert on a wide plateau just above the Columbia River, where there wasn't anything for miles and miles except sagebrush and willow. It was just Lance, me, and two shotguns. He gave me the 410 and kept the 12-gauge for himself. He showed me how to load, cock, and fire. We shot at bushes for practice. Then we moved on to trees. Some of the little ones we cut in half. Boom. It sounded like a cannon, and it jerked my whole body back. Lance laughed. You gotta hold it against your shoulder and brace yourself, he said. Boom. I had never felt that kind of power in my hands before. I was amazed at the mechanics of it. My finger would pull this little hook of metal, and something over there would break apart. I pulled the trigger and put holes in things. I made things disappear. Lance laughed. Anybody here know Lance Davis from Oregon? Good. All right. Just wanted to cover myself here. After shredding a couple of trees, we moved on to birds. We were supposed to be hunting ducks, but we ended up shooting all kinds of birds. Seagulls, hawks, crows, little gray birds that looked like sparrows. Some I hit, some I didn't. Some I'll never know because they flew off, maybe carrying a pellet inside their bodies. I remember this owl sitting on a tree limb looking like a wise old man with a round head and curious yellow eyes. Lance shot it in the face. I kept shooting even though a part of me was feeling sick. By that afternoon, Lance and I were shooting anything that moved. Squirrels, chipmunks, rabbits. Target practice, that's all it was. Just pulling the trigger and making things fall. The afternoon went by like an adrenaline dream. Late in the day, I hit a bird and picked it up. It was another small one like a sparrow, and it wasn't bloody except for a small dot on its neck. As I held it in my hand, it kept rolling its head and its eyes blinked. Some people say birds don't feel pain, that they're just mounds of reflex, but this bird seemed to be feeling real pain. It took a long time to die. I'm 45 now, and I look back on that day privately with shame. It wasn't the killing of animals necessarily, although that's part of it. I've come to love animals intensely. But I'm a meat eater, and I accept that other organisms will die to nourish me. The shame and horror come from witnessing my capacity as a young man to be pulled into an experience unthinkingly, carried off by a current of the moment, someone else's intoxication. It was my capacity to be a participant in senseless destruction. I write for a newspaper now. A few years ago, I went to the Washington State Penitentiary to interview a young man serving 52 years for murder. It was a drive-by shooting. His name was Brian. He was 16 when he took out a semi-automatic pistol and sprayed 8 bullets toward a crowd of high school students. One of the bullets hit a 17-year-old girl named Melissa. The bullet went in behind her ear and then broke into 3 fragments inside her brain, making 3 different paths. In the hospital, her head swelled up to the size of a basketball, and her mother wailed at the sight of her daughter, whom she no longer recognized. Melissa died after a day. In prison, Brian told me, as he'd told police all along, that he didn't mean to kill anybody. He was just trying to scare people, he said. He'd never shot a gun before. He'd never committed a crime before. He was a squeaky clean kid except for that one day, that one afternoon when he got in a car with some people who were living their own hallucination. He kept telling me, "I didn't mean it. I just got caught up. I just got caught up." There was a part of me that had no choice but to believe him, the part that came into being in the Oregon sagebrush so many years ago. It didn't matter. This young man had let himself be swept away by a moment of madness, and he destroyed a beautiful young woman named Melissa. Utterly destroyed her. Boom. Just like that, blood and hair and weeping, and she was gone forever. He deserved the 52 years. He deserved every minute of it. It's the way the mechanics work when they're working. You pull that hook of metal, and things fall, and faces you wish you'd never seen visit you in your dreams.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tomas Alex Tezon is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We'll hear more readings from the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to writers and their stories told through the craft of narrative journalism. Maria Arana is editor-in-chief of Bookworld at the Washington Post and an author in her own right. Tonight, she reads from her memoir, American Chica, 2 Worlds, 1 Childhood.
There is laughter. There is the sharp report of a slamming door and the staccato of high heels crossing the ceramic tiles of the atrium garden. There is the reveille shout to the servants' quarters, the slap of sandals making their way to the animal pens, the squawk of chickens as they are pulled from their cages, one by one, into the ink of night. It is 3 o'clock before the light of day. I rub the sleep from my eyes, swing my legs over the side of my bed until my toes touch the yama rug, and then sniff the air of a morning, like all my mornings, redolent of ripe bananas, raw sugar, rum, and the sharp ferric odor of freshly drawn blood. I cross the room, hoist myself onto the window ledge, pull back the heavy wrought iron, and lean out into the dark. The second floor vantage offers me a rich display of the courtyard below. My mother is floating into view, her green dress billowing like a gossamer wing, her long gold hair throwing light like a tungsten filament, her all-American Hollywood face alive with expectation. At her side is my Peruvian father, black-haired, handsome, smiling, and shouting Spanish over his shoulder, waving a bottle in his fist as if he were a carnival barker on opening day. His friends spill in behind them. Through the kitchen window, I see the cook yawning and plucking feathers from a chicken, letting the blood ooze from its neck into the frying pan for an early morning sangrecita. I do not read omens in that. I do not yet know about signs. My parents are young. It is their moment. Every marriage has one. When love seems infinite, the road feels free, and nights trip festively into day. I was only four, but life had already had upheavals. The year I came into the world, five major earthquakes shook Peru. By the time I stood at that window, I'd lived through 18. I cannot recollect any one of them. Off in a geologist's lab, a needle was dancing, wild, registering one disaster after another. 3 days before I dangled my head into that courtyard, a quake ripped through the Peruvian seaboard, registering almost 8 points on the Richter scale. It started shortly after 5 p.m. The men were at work, the women in kitchens, their children at play. Where was I? The entire population of our hacienda must have heard the rumble beneath, felt the waggle in the stomach, seen concrete slabs wrench loose and skitter across ground, across, then up in fragments, belching gray dust. Walls usually rip before a mind can factor it. Roofs fall, babies hurl through air. I know it happened only because the World Data Center for Seismology tells me so. Earthquake, December 12, 1953, South America, latitude 4 degrees, longitude 80 degrees, magnitude 7.8, displacements, thousands, deaths, severe. Shaky days. Yet all I can recall of them is a pre-dawn tableau, my mother and father bursting into our garden with joy. As I grew older and learned to register the ground beneath my feet, I saw that my parents' marriage was shot through with fissures, something like earthquakes would come, geologic upheavals when the foundations that underlay their union would rattle with dislocation and longing. But now, just now, in the 8th year of marriage, with 3 children upstairs and my father's engineering career in ascendance, in that quick freeze frame before dawn, the gulf between them did not matter much. They were full. They were one. And I, hovering above their world, was seamless and faultless and whole. A South American man, a North American woman, hoping against hope, throwing a frail span over the divide, trying to bolt beams into sand. There was one large lesson they had yet to learn as they strode into the garden with friends, hungry for rum and fried blood. There is a fundamental rift between North and South America, a flaw so deep it is tectonic. The plates don't fit. The earth is loose. A fault runs through. Earthquakes happen. Walls are likely to fall. As I looked down at their fleeting radiance, I had no idea I would spend the rest of my life puzzling over them. They were so different from each other, so obverse in every way. I did not know that however resolutely they built their bridge, I would only wander its middle, never quite reaching either side. These were things I was slow to understand. Thank you.
Maria Arana is author of American Chica, Two Worlds, One Childhood. Writer Deborah Dickerson reads from An American Story, a memoir of her childhood in working-class black St. Louis, growing up as the daughter of Great Migration sharecroppers.
Since childhood, I'd been an insomniac and fitful sleeper tormented by the least light, the lightest footfall. Now I knew a blissful vacuum as my brother spitefully did his laundry 10 feet from my head, boombox blaring. My sisters filled our basement with their chattering girlfriends or gossiped on the phone, but I never knew they were there. Awake, I never thought farther ahead than the next order of fries, the next mess to be cleaned up after my brother Bobby, the next book I could read. By July, my mother pointed out to me that the only clothing of mine in the laundry pile was underwear, my work uniform, and my nightgown. I could only shrug. What else did I need? I even sent others to the library for me, that holy of holies, the place I used to wish to be locked in accidentally overnight, the way other kids wish they could be locked in a candy store. I lived on chocolate cupcakes and Pepsi, snarfed down in bed, and gained back all the weight I'd lost from my fatty four-eyes girlhood. Then August began, and I couldn't sleep a wink. I prowled the house all night, book in hand, while everyone else slept. As in my childhood, I was again moving from window to window, staring into the pre-dawn darkness without ever knowing what I was looking for, wishing I was dead. I used to think then about people in ancient times struggling with things they didn't understand, but which we now have names and fixes for. Imagine being a slave with asthma, a manic depressive medieval woodsman, an epileptic Russian serf. I knew there was something wrong with me, and I knew it had a name, but because I was a coward and a conformist, I didn't think there was a cure. With all the extra exhausted hours in my days, I spun out one Walter Mitty fantasy after another and prayed they'd be enough. I assumed I'd learned to tune out the way my mother did as she floated above the drudgery of her life with a 1,000 miles away smile on her face that had nothing to do with us. And then, one mid-August morning, 1 week before what should have been my freshman year was to begin, I looked out the window and saw my future gaining on me. Outside, the neighborhood women were trudging off to their lives. They thronged the bus stops, pinch-faced and sullen, in their run-over shoes and cheap fabrics, a name tag pinned to every overflowing bosom. The old crones were difficult to distinguish from the young women. I could tell they'd all already been up for hours, preparing breakfast and lunches, wrangling with their irresponsible kids' kids, arguing with their husbands and sons, perhaps late because the electricity had been turned off again during the night. After 9 years riding city buses to school and work, that morning I noticed for the first time that no one speaks at a bus stop, not in the early morning. My own head was always buried in a book, unless it was winter and too dark to read. Most everyone else stood slumped in his or her own pre-Walkman misery, trying to catch a few fleeting moments rest while standing, trying to enjoy those last few moments of freedom. I opened the window and pressed my face to the iron bars, unable to look away. All at once, my future spread out before me, an endless stream of letters to be typed and coffee to be fetched. I couldn't breathe. Literally, I could not breathe. Gasping for air, I ran downstairs to the basement, threw street clothes on for the first time in weeks, drove my mother to work, then used the car to speed back up West Florissant Avenue to Florissant Valley Community College. It wouldn't open for 2 hours, so I paced outside the administration building, nearly hysterical with panic and fear that I was having a heart attack. Then I begged the first person who arrived for work to admit me.
Deborah Dickerson is author of An American Story and The End of Blackness. And we close tonight's readings with Lan Ung, a survivor of the killing fields in Cambodia and author of the best-selling book, First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers. Here she remembers her first 4th of July celebration as a 10-year-old girl in Vermont.
After a few moments of searching, Joe finds a bench in the first row with enough room for all of us. All around, children scream with joy. Their arms shoot out sparklers and flap like dragonflies. Somewhere in the distance, a band plays songs I've never heard. The drums and cymbals roll and clash thunderously, lifting me up into the air before the tuba drags me down back to earth. Above us, the stars twinkle like eyes of the gods, blinking in and out, as if they're spying on our festivities. It's almost time. It's almost time, the crowd whispers. The crowds hutter in the dark, forming bumps on the field resembling burial mounds. It's almost time, the mass exhale. My skin moistened from the sounds of crackling gunshots. Any moment now, the swarm murmurs. Perspiration forms above my lips. I wrap my arms around myself. Suddenly, a cannonball shoots into the air. The brilliant explosion hovers over me. My hands clasp over my ears, my eyes shut. I brace myself for the oncoming war. The smell of burnt powder, the brightness of the bombs, and the haze of smoke are so terrifying that even the star leaves us and disappears back into their black holes. Somewhere in the crowd, a baby scream. Its cries jump into my head and are trapped in my skull, flooding my senses. Another explosion sends me scurrying under the bench, but Ming grabs my arm and holds me in my seat. In my seat, my throat closes as I gasp for air. Suddenly, I'm outside of time and space, in a world where Cambodia and America collide, with me stuck somewhere in the middle. A baby scream as the soldiers reach into the bomb shelter and pull out a woman. Her clothes are black and dirty and her face is muddy. She clutches her baby to her breast and begs for mercy, taking me back to the desk of Ma and my sister Gik. All of a sudden, my world goes red and I'm back in America, disoriented, terrified. As the sky continues to open and explode, I count quietly under my breath, inhaling the falling ashes and damp earth through my nose and mouth. One, two, three. I breathe as pictures of Cambodian America are superimposed on top of one another. My eyes shut. I pray the rockets will not hit my shelter and bury me alive. In the night sky, the gods battle their grand finale. In the bomb shelter, the Cambodians get on their knees, their palms together and press against their chest. They live singing incantations and prayers for the war to stop. Not caring, the gods throw firestorms and lightning, tearing the sky apart while the souls of the Cambodian people hide deep within the earth. In my mind's eye, I see my friend Pithy crouching next to me. Her mother and brother huddle together beside her. Another explosion splits open so loudly that even the gods desert us. In my head, a mother screams and I turn to see Pithy. Her head cracked like a coconut, her blood oozing out of her wounds. "I'm so sorry, Pithy," I whisper. Pithy's 9-year-old body lies unmoving, slowly sinking into the earth. "I am so sorry." I want to scream, but my mouth is dry, my spit cake around my lips. I clamp my hands over my ears and press my eyes closed, trying to squeeze Pithy out. Then all is quiet. The bombs stop, the soldiers retreat, and the baby sleep in its mother's arm, knowing that the war will never scar its mind or stay in its soul. The world shifts back into place, and slowly Cambodia recedes from my focus, leaving me again in America. In the dark, Ming's voice called out to me, his hand reaching into my shelter to pull me out. The mask departs. Everyone is smiling and laughing. "That was a wonderful show. What a wonderful, exciting show."
Lan Ung is author of the best-selling book, First They Killed My Father. Her second book, Lucky Child, will be published next year. Join us tomorrow night for part two of our broadcast of readings from the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Special thanks tonight to Mark Kramer at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism and to Buck Ewing at Cambridge Transcriptions. For more information about the conference, visit our website at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Lauren Madelon, and Tim Skoge. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.